This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, in what was almost a stunning suppression of free speech, several of our elected officials tried last week to prevent survivors and eyewitnesses from the flotilla disaster from telling their firsthand stories.
We're talking about people who should know better. Representatives Jerry Nadler, Christine Quinn, Anthony Weiner, Carolyn Mahoney, Charles Rangel. They're telling us we have no right to hear what these people have to say. And they baited them with terrorism charges, which are blatantly untrue in as much as the Israelis offloaded all those supplies and there was nothing on them.
24 anti-torture activists were acquitted in a trial last week for protesting at the U.S. Capitol.
Ironically, on the day that Obama had promised to close the prison detention camp at Guantanamo. If the judge would have been consistent, he would have detained them forever.
A new group is calling to seize the assets of BP sufficient to compensate the people they harm.
Carl Massenio, who heads the group, is saying seize their assets because otherwise it's going to be a 20-year stalling morass, just like what Exxon did at the Valdez.
Stay with us.
Over the last couple of years, we've brought you interviews with Emily Kunstler and Sarah Kunstler, who are the directors of the film William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe, a fabulous film about this radical lawyer taking you through his trials from the Chicago 8 to Wounded Knee to Attica. Well, here's the good news. On June 22nd, that's next Tuesday, you'll have a chance to see that film for free on public television. It's on POV, Point of View, Public Television. You'll have to look up the time, but again, it will be playing on POV, Disturbing the Universe, by Emily Kunstler and Sarah Kunstler.
Michael and Michael, we have a new development in the case of the Cuban Five, a case that we've been covering for years, it seems.
While the Cuban Five have been sitting in five separate maximum security prisons, and now it turns out that the government was paying reporters to put information out to influence the jury at the trial. Michael, what are the details on it?
Here's how I would characterize it. The reporters who were writing for some of the major newspapers in Miami, which the jury read and could read and read before, and we, of course, claimed there was pretrial publicity that was harmful to the defendants, those same reporters had moonlighting jobs with a station called Radio Marti or TV Marti, and that's a federal government propaganda effort. They used to have a balloon up in the air that has an antenna attached to it that broadcasts to Cuba. So while, let's say, whatever someone's name was writing an article in the Miami Herald about the Cuban Five case, that someone or reporter was also being paid by the federal government to write propaganda against Cuba that went over Radio Marti. So in other words, can you really trust this guy's reporting for the Miami Herald or whatever? And it does seem that, of course, considering that one of the key issues in the case was whether it was a fair and impartial jury that was free from the publicity of the city of Miami and the town of Miami, that the fact that all of the newspapers apparently were biased and having reports written really by people paid by the very federal government that wanted to get the Cuban Five convicted would seem to be a significant new fact in the case that, in my view, should entitle them to a reversal of their convictions.
As some would say that it would entitle them to be freed, we should mention propaganda is illegal under the Smith-Mundt Act. It used to be called the U.S. Informational and Educational Exchange Act of 1948. But basically, this government must announce if it is paying journalists to write in U.S. newspapers or other media propaganda. And that's what happened here.
Right. What their argument is we were paying him to write on Radio Marti. They had their separate salary from the newspaper. But, you know, that's like ridiculous. All they're doing is they're trying to get around what Heidi, you're referring to is the law by saying, okay, we're not going to pay you for writing for the Miami Herald, but we'll give you another gig on the side to write about the same thing.
It's clearly a conflict of interest and corrupt. But more than that, it stands democracy on its head. The government's supposed to reflect the will of the people. It's not supposed to influence what the people think.
It deviates from well-established journalistic principles, fairness and accuracy in the media. But the instant appeal that we're facing is not for all of the five. We should just mention it's for Gerardo Hernandez, who was looking at two life sentences plus 15 more years in prison. So this is a new important aspect of the appeal that was just filed. It represents for many supporters of the five a glimmer of hope in what had been a very depressing case.
Really?
Michael, we've talked a lot on this show about the case of Mahar Arar. Is there an update for us?
Mahar Arar, as our listeners I'm sure will remember, is the man who was whipped off a plane at Kennedy 7 or 8 years ago by the United States, taken by U.S. little private CIA jets to Jordan and then into Syria, where he was left in an underground torture cell for 10 months and 10 days and tortured. U.S. people most likely involved in feeding him the questions, etc. But U.S. people sending him, really, in a classic rendition of an innocent man, to Syria, where he was tortured. After he eventually was released through lots of efforts from particularly Canadians, there were a number of inquiries started. Canada exonerated Mahar Arar completely, had a big investigation, paid him $9 million Canadian funds. Not that that ended it, his case in Canada, but he was certainly rehabilitated to the extent he could be in Canada by that. The U.S. has fared quite differently. Mahar Arar, despite the fact that he was found completely innocent by the Canadians, is still on the U.S. terrorist list, can't enter the United States. That's under Obama, not just Bush. And the lawsuit that was filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights on his behalf has had a long and tortured history. A year ago or so, or less than a year, going to the Second Circuit here in New York, eventually the entire 12 judges of the court hearing the case. It was a case against the various people in the federal government who were responsible for sending him to a country where it was more likely than not, or in fact where they knew, he would be tortured. Unfortunately, Mahar Arar lost that case 7-5. In the Court of Appeals in the Second Circuit. The Center for Constitutional Rights and Mahar Arar, then asked the Supreme Court to look at the case. And the question is pretty stark. Can U.S. officials pick up someone off an airplane without any process when that person lands in the United States, hustle them off to some U.S. prison for a few days while they get them ready to get on a private jet to take them to a known torture chamber, an underground prison, in Syria, which U.S. state reports have stated, routinely tortures people over the last 25 years, routinely. So they knew it. They did it purposely. A number of defendants were alleged to have been involved, both the people at Justice Department, Immigration, Ashcroft, etc. Last week, the Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to hear the case. In other words, cert denied. So we have a situation now in which essentially this administration upheld in the courts fighting for the fact that U.S. officials would be immune from taking Canadian citizens off U.S. planes and sending them to places of torture. A very, very bad ruling. Okay. Now, that's only the first aspect of Arar. Michael, yes?
Well, how many judges does it take to have the Supreme Court accept cert and review a case?
It takes four to grant
four.
Cert.
Four?
It's four to grant cert.
So we couldn't even muster four. Supposedly there are four, quote, liberal judges. We couldn't even get four people on the Supreme Court to look at this.
Well, one reason maybe, and I don't want to say maybe, but Sotomayor couldn't sit on the case because she heard the arguments below. So she couldn't sit. So you're down to, of the so-called moderate liberals, you're down to three. So they couldn't get enough. And sometimes even if you have the four, they don't want to hear it, because they know they're going to lose because they got five that are pretty sure against them.
Yeah.
So, but in any case, it's a denial. It really means that we still have in place a practice of rendition that's been essentially affirmed by the failure of the courts to consider the damages for this man, Mahar Arar. And you have President Obama still keeping him on the terrorist list.
And he wants Kagan to be the next Supreme Court judge. What was her position on this?
Solicitor's office would have, it wasn't argued, they would have had to oppose cert. That's correct. Now, we have two other developments on rendition, one on Mahar Arar. The one on Mahar Arar that's interesting is on the same day that happened, Mahar Arar in Canada revealed that the RCMP, now all of you who have fun as kids, you know, watching Mounted Police, that stands for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, you know, those guys on horses in those slick uniforms. The RCMP is conducting a criminal investigation into conduct of U.S. officials for rendition. So we actually have a case opened in Canada now about a Canadian citizen with regard to the complicity of Ashcroft and company, we presume, for the illegal rendition to torture of Machar Arar. That's one good development. The second good development is the European High Court for Human Rights has taken one of the rendition cases. They've taken the Massary case, in which a man named Massary, a German citizen, was traveling on a vacation somewhere and was eventually picked up in Macedonia by the Macedonian officials and police and rendered and given to the United States, obviously under the U.S. orders, taken to Afghanistan, etc. He's gotten no justice anywhere. Macedonia was sued for what it did to him. European Union's Human Rights Court has now taken that case. So we're actually seeing at least some foreign countries beginning to start to poke the United States a bit. So for Machar Arar, a bad decision here, obviously, in the U.S., some movement in Canada, possibly, and some movement in rendition on the Massary case in the European Human Rights Court.
Michael, can you give us an update on the Nuremberg case?
Some of our listeners may recall. If they don't, they can go to our website and find some of the history of the Nuremberg case. But that's the case in which three or four young men were alleged to have gathered up rockets and even a Stinger missile or something, which I think they never had, for attacks on some kind of synagogues in Riverdale and maybe a U.S. Army base, etc. And it was a huge stink when it came out, front page everywhere. And in our show, we interviewed a former FBI agent, and we asked him about the role in this particular Nuremberg case of an informant. There was an older man who was an informant, not just an informant, he was an undercover FBI guy, at least working for the FBI's undercover. And he's the one who apparently got these young men into everything. He promised them $250,000 and a BMW. They didn't have driver's licenses. They didn't know anything. And he kept stringing them along. The trial was set to go last week before a federal judge. Apparently, some documents just got turned over to the defense by the government. And those documents indicate even a bigger role for the informant undercover guy than we ever expected. There's one in there that I recall, and I'm just recalling this. Someone at the FBI notified an airport that some of these defendants would be looking at the airport. And he said, don't worry about them looking at the airport. There's nothing they can do. They don't know how to do anything without us. And that's one of the documents that had been withheld by the FBI or by the federal government from the defense. So the judge sees this, and you can tell the judge is, I think, at her wit's end about this. And she basically gave an extension of a number of months. And then next week, there's going to be a bail hearing. And I think they want people to pack the court at the bail hearing because there's a fair chance the Nuremberg Four are going to get out of jail because this looks like a complete setup from Jump Street.
It's worth noting that the original arrest of the Nuremberg Four was timed to coincide with a federal holiday. I believe it was Memorial Day. And that's something that we've seen in a lot of these highly publicized so-called terrorism-related trials.
Now, why is that, Heidi?
I think it plays on the sensibilities of patriotism, helps get the government's message out that they're doing something to protect the country.
Last week, two eyewitnesses who were aboard the Turkish ship that was stormed in international waters by the Israeli naval commandos told their stories at the Brooklyn Historic House of the Lord Church. As many listeners know, nine unarmed passengers were murdered. The oldest, Ibrahim Bilgin, was 61, and the youngest, Furkan Dogan, a U.S.-born citizen, age 19, was killed by four shots to the forehead. This speaking event almost didn't happen. Last Monday, June 14th, City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, U.S. Congressional Representatives Jerry Nadler, Anthony Weiner, Carolyn Mahoney, and Charles Rangel, and others gathered in Times Square to demand that the State Department investigate the invited speakers for, quote, ties to terrorism. They wanted to prevent or delay their entry into the United States. To get an update on this, we're joined by Bill Doors with New York Labor Against the War. Bill Doors, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
What are you doing with respect to getting the truth out about what happened to the Free Gaza flotilla?
Well, we're having a public meeting at the House of the Lord Church on 415 Atlantic Avenue, Reverend Daughtry's church. We are bringing in two people who were on the ship, who were eyewitnesses to the atrocity that occurred there, the Mavi Marmara, U.S. filmmaker Yara Lee, who taped the Israeli attack, and Kevin Ovenden, who was attaché to George Galloway and has organized three convoys to Gaza, one of which I was on last year, for Viva Palestina, and also Ahmet Faruk Unsal, who is a former member of Turkey's parliament and a member of the Turkish Humanitarian Relief Organization, IHH.
And we understand that you're having some trouble, that several congresspeople, including Jerry Nadler, Anthony Weiner, rallied in New York City on June 14th and said that these people should be investigated by the State Department because of their, quote, ties to terrorism. What's the story with that?
Well, it's pretty appalling, as you said. Here we have a group of liberal Democrats, Jerry Nadler, Anthony Weiner, Carolyn Mahoney, Elliot Engel, Charles Rangel, Scott Stringer, Manhattan Borough President, and Christine Quinn, acting like right-wing Republicans or acting like fascists, shamelessly calling the victims of the crime, people who were kidnapped on the high seas, taken into custody, taken to Israel by force after nine of their shipmates were shot dead. Many were shot in the head several times. The oldest, Ibrahim Bilgin, was 61 years old. The youngest, Furkan Dugadogan, was 19. He was a U.S. citizen born in Troy, New York. I thought the U.S. government was supposed to protect its citizens. Now we have these politicians who basically they're saying that anyone who speaks out against Israel in any way or shape or form or is a terrorist, that's their view.
I mean, these are the what we call the Amen choir for anything Israel does, anything. Amen, anything. And, you know, we've seen them before. We've seen a group of these people who were the ones, Nadler in particular, who signed the petition against the Goldstone Report. And to do this now around the free speech issue of people coming into New York to talk about what happened on the flotilla, again, just shows they leave their human rights at the door when it comes to Israel.
Precisely. Their hands, in my opinion, are dripping with blood because they voted for and pushed for every appropriation for every weapon of mass destruction, every horrible terror weapon that Israel has used in Gaza in 2008, 2009, in January, in Lebanon in 2006, where thousands died in those two wars, including hundreds of civilians, hundreds of children. Many more left without arms and legs. That's terrorism. As is this vicious blockade that has denied the people of Gaza the necessities of life for 4 years. And they're doing a classic tactic of any oppressive regime to blame the victim, to accuse the victims of being terrorists. Anthony Weiner was ranting about this ship was barreling towards the shores and nobody knew what was on it. This was a publicly proclaimed mission. Anthony Weiner actually called those who died and those who were on the ship terrorists.
Just so disgusting, it's not to be believed.
What kind of terrorists don't carry guns? I mean,
shocking. I mean, it's been that way, unfortunately, consistently. You know, there was a rally of some of these same people at the beginning of the Gaza War. These people got together and rallied in favor of the Gaza War. They then, when Goldstone came out with his report criticizing Israel and Palestinians for what happened in the Gaza War, they then again, some of these same people voted against the U.S. doing anything in any fora with regard to the Goldstone Report, and now this. I agree with you. Blood is on their hands. They're complicitous.
Now, in fact, Richard Goldstone, a South African magistrate who is Jewish and who is actually a Zionist, considers himself a Zionist, is banned from visiting the State of Israel. I guess he's a terrorist also. Maybe the Israeli Naval Reserve officers who say that it was wrong what Israel did, maybe they're terrorists too. Just trying to intimidate any opposition by spreading the label of terrorist around.
These various representatives of ours called for the State Department to investigate these speakers that come in here. Did they get any traction with that?
Not that we've heard, and we trust not, because there is absolutely no basis for that. These people are political organizers. The State Department has been unable to put IHH on any kind of list in spite of allegations to the contrary.
IHH is the Turkish charity.
IHH is the Turkish charity which operates in 106 countries, including Haiti. Kevin Ovenden is a political organizer and activist, a British citizen. Yara Lee lives here. She's a U.S. citizen. There's no basis, and we trust that these folks will all be permitted to come in. Mr. Unsal has been to the United States many times before in his capacity as a member of parliament.
I'd like you just to mention the names of our city and federal government officials who have actually buried the First Amendment on this issue, buried the human rights violations that Israel has been engaged in, and are willing to, as I said, leave human rights at the door when it comes to any criticism of Israel.
City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer, Representatives Jerry Nadler, Anthony Weiner, Carolyn Mahoney, Elliot Engel, and Charles Wrangel.
Each one of these people, really, in my view, by covering over, not allowing information about Israeli crimes to come out, encourages Israel again and again to act with impunity again and again. So if you hear these guys, if you see them, say something.
What kind of demands are you going to be making at the rally?
Well, the rally is to get out the truth. I mean, clearly, for these people, there's nothing that Israel can do, absolutely nothing that Israel can do that would make it wrong in their eyes. But we want the people in this country to hear the truth. But I think the real issue for us here in this country is to end the blockade on Gaza. And the ships are going to keep coming. They're going to have to keep killing people or jailing people because we're not going to stop. The people of the world are not going to stop until this blockade ends. And we will also an end to U.S. arms to Israel. Every bullet fired was paid for by the United States. Those commandos who landed on that ship and killed a U.S. citizen were paid by our tax dollars. The bombs that fell on Gaza were provided by our tax dollars, and that's got to stop.
Bill, do you have a website that people can go to for more information?
Yes, info@al-awdany.org.
Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Last week, 24 anti-torture activists were acquitted in a trial for protesting at the U.S. Capitol, calling for Guantanamo's closure and an investigation of deaths at the prisoner detention camp. The activists were acquitted of charges of unlawful entry with disorderly conduct, which stemmed from demonstrations on January 21st of this year. That was the date President Obama promised to close Guantanamo prison. With his decision, the judge validated the effort of the demonstrators to condemn the ongoing crime of indefinite detention at Guantanamo, says Bill Quigley, legal advisor to the defendants and the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Bill Quigley gives us a brief update on the case.
Bill Quigley, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you. I appreciate coming back.
And I know you're just back from trials in Washington, D.C., concerning the Catholic worker or witness against torture people. You had an amazing victory there with 24 people being acquitted. Why don't you give us a little background? I know it goes back to January 21st, which was supposedly the year anniversary of Guantanamo being that it was supposed to be closed by Obama. And what happened?
Well, there was a big protest on the day that Guantanamo was supposed to be closed by the group Witness Against Torture, who really started off in 2005 when they traveled to Cuba and walked up to the gates of Guantanamo asking that the people there be released or, given due process. And this group of people has been protesting, educating, organizing, working with legislators and others ever since then. And in January this year, they had a number of people who fasted a water-only fast for 11 days. It ended on the day of this protest, and they put, I think, like 20-something people on the steps of the Capitol who were in orange jumpsuits and black hoods. They had the names of a Guantanamo detainee. Each of them had a different name on their uniform. They were arrested on the steps of the Capitol, and they refused to give their names. They gave only the names of the people who were still being detained at Guantanamo. And then about an hour later, another 14 went inside the Capitol to the rotunda, and they joined a tour. And in the middle of the tour, when it was in the rotunda, they unfurled a big banner and put rose petals all around and started holding a protest and prayer vigil and memorial service and everything there in the rotunda.
You know, I've been working on and off, as have you, with Catholic Worker and Witness Against Torture for many, many years. But the courage they have is just...
I mean, and the creativity.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, you know, how many people would just do that?
What I don't understand is why isn't this disorderly conduct and unlawful entry as they were charged with?
Well, let's finish the story.
Yeah,
okay, so we left you off. They joined a tour, rose petals, prayer, et cetera. What next?
Then they arrested the 14 people inside, so they had about 35, 38 people that had been arrested. And the trial was set for this week. They gave people the option of... paying a $50 fine and not even having a conviction. But most of the people wouldn't accept that. They insisted on their right to go to trial, and they wanted to put Guantanamo itself on trial in the Superior Court of Washington, D.C. So this group, Witness Against Torture, had been working for several weeks with people taking up the various legal roles in court. Most of the people were pro se, and so they did their own opening, they did their own, they had their closings mapped out, they had cross-examinations, they had different people testifying and the like.
Was any of this videoed?
No, unfortunately.
Too bad.
Yeah. And so the role that I played is that I prepared and argued a motion for the necessity defense and international law defense and the importance of the First Amendment to what they were doing. What happened was that the judge, who was a Judge Cannon, C-A-N-A-N, he had been on the bench for maybe 10 years, but he was a death penalty defense lawyer.
Wow.
Before he became a judge. He, you know, started the trial, was very respectful of everybody and all that, but after sort of the preliminary matters, when it became clear what this trial was about, you could see sort of a cloud going over his face. And in the argument, I analogized their conduct to the people who resisted in Germany against the illegal crimes of Hitler and the like, and the responsibility that citizens have to challenge the crimes of their government, and the protection that people, that international law and the Nuremberg principles and other things should provide to people who challenge the crimes. The judge asked a few questions about Guantanamo. He was actually surprised to learn that there were still people in Guantanamo who had been cleared either by the courts or by the United States itself, but were still being detained. He had heard a little bit about the torture that had actually occurred in Guantanamo, but didn't know a lot about that. But in that dialogue that we were having, you could see that he was sort of reevaluating his position in this. And so he turned down, he denied the request to dismiss the case based on international law and the necessity defense, but he warned the prosecutor that he was going to really hold the prosecutor to the letter of the law in terms of what the charge was. So the prosecutor put on a couple of officers who said, we, you know, saw these people doing this, and we went up and warned them not to do it. We asked them three times to leave. They never left, and so we arrested them. The D.C. prosecutors had charged them with unlawful assembly with intent to breach the peace. And the judge, at the conclusion of the prosecution's case, there were two of the pro se defendants who got up to argue a motion of acquittal on the basis of First Amendment and the illegality and that. And the judge said, well, I think the First Amendment's very important, but I see here that the prosecution charged these folks with intent to disturb the peace, and under a recent decision of our court in earlier this year, in 2010, breach of peace is what they were charged with. Under the breach of peace, there has to be some sort of incitement to violence. And he said, now, some of these folks, maybe the ones on the inside, might have actually been unlawfully assembled. He said, I'm not so sure about those on the outside. They may have been exercising their First Amendment activities to bring their speech and their petition for redress of grievances in a peaceable assembly to the seat of government. And he went on and anguished with it for a little while, asked a few questions of the prosecutor, and then turned around and dismissed all the cases of the 24 people who were still going to trial.
Congratulations to defendants, the Catholic Worker and Witness Against Torture, and Bill Quigley.
Well, I think actually it's much larger than that, certainly the defendants in that. But I do think that the work of everybody in the United States and internationally that's been working on Guantanamo was settling into this judge's mind that he did not want to be on the wrong side of history, as so many of us in the United States and around the world. When, you know, Bush did it, we thought that was terrible and expected much more from President Obama. And the fact that he hasn't done it, Congress seems to be, you know, pushing it further and further away. I think people realize that this is not just an embarrassment, it's sort of an open wound on the idea of what the United States is supposed to stand for. And I think the judge was actually decided he didn't want to get involved in this, and so he figured his own way out of the case. So I think perhaps it's you know, it's a little sign that maybe we have a chance of really turning the tide, that people of intellect and people of, you know, are committed to justice realize that this thing is has gone on way too long, people have to be able to stand up and do something about it.
Bill, this reminds me of a case that came out of a Washington state court in the last several months in which a judge did a similar thing and refused to dismiss a case and said that the defendants could have their day in court to present their moral reasons for engaging in civil disobedience. One by one, these brave judges around the country, hopefully this is the beginning of a trend.
Yes. I mean, you know, these folks were all ready to go to jail. Some of them had, you know, were going to go straight from the courtroom to jail because they weren't going to pay any fines or that. So they were ready. The judge knew they were ready. The judge understood what they were about. He spoke respectfully of what they had done, the way they had done it, and was obviously impressed. So, we have to celebrate when we have the chance to celebrate, and this is certainly something worth celebrating.
That's for sure. It does remind me a little bit of the 60s and the 70s. When as slowly popular opinion shifted on the war, it also shifted in the courtroom.
That's right. That's right. And I do think it means that if people spend more than 2 or 3 minutes thinking about something, that they would in fact see that there is much more going on there, and what they know about what's going on there and what they learn about what's going on there horrifies them.
Well, thank you, Bill Quigley.
Thanks,
for being there.
Okay, thank all of you for passing the word on and doing all the good work you do for justice.
Congratulations again, Bill. Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
I was dreaming. In my dreaming, we'll have an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping here was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly open, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace is showered. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power.
As the blood-red crude oil continues to gush from the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, countless industries and communities are being hit hard economically and environmentally. Meanwhile, British Petroleum, Halliburton, and Transocean sidestep compensation and trade blame. Organizers of the Seize BP campaign have a demand that they say is straightforward. Seize assets of BP sufficient to compensate the people they harm. There are several paths to compensation, says Carl Massinio, attorney with the Partnership for Civil Justice and organizer of the Seize BP group. First, the BP claims process whereby BP determines what to cover and how much to pay. On this road, all power rests with BP. Second, through the courts, where people can file litigation and lawsuits against BP. Both BP and the Obama administration want to push everyone seeking compensation down these two paths. But these two paths lead nowhere, according to Massinio. Third, the seizure of BP's assets in an amount commensurate with estimated damages and the delivery of immediate and ongoing compensation to all those who have suffered and will suffer lost jobs, wages, and business for years to come. Attorney Carl Massinio with the Partnership for Civil Justice and with Seize BP joins us today. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Carl.
Well, thank you for having me.
Carl, we're here to discuss Seize BP, a new campaign that I understand you are instrumental in forming. Can you explain what this is?
Well, Seize BP is a campaign that was started, of course, just a number of weeks ago around a single simple demand, which is that the U.S. government needs to seize assets of BP, place them in trust, and make them immediately available for the people of the Gulf Coast who are in such severe desperation at this time. We're witnessing a catastrophe of remarkable proportion, and at the same time, a level of inactivity and non-responsiveness from the Obama administration that is just striking. I mean, the people in the Gulf should be entitled to go to sleep every night knowing that they will be taken care of financially, that they will be able to put food on the table, that they will be able to pay the rent, to pay the note on their fishing trawler, that they are not going to be suffering any further from this catastrophe for which they have no responsibility whatsoever.
What could he have done? He went on the air last week.
Yes, a lot of rhetoric. But, you know, people cannot eat rhetoric. People cannot pay the mortgage with rhetoric. People are looking to the president. And the president is a leader of a party which happens to control the majority of both chambers of Congress. They have the full authority of the state. They have the Commerce Clause. They are able to take action if they choose to. They could seize assets of BP, take those assets, put them in trust, and ensure that there is a simplified claims process that takes care of the people that are so desperately harmed.
Well, Obama, when he went on the air, was quick to say that he's going to meet with the chairman of BP and make sure that there are assets available to people who have been harmed.
Require them to set up an escrow fund.
An independently run trust fund.
Oh, those are nice words, and we think that that's an excellent concept. That's what's necessary. But the president of the United States needs to request Tony Hayward to please set aside some money, to please make some partial compensation for this massive scope of damage that BP has caused. The president has legal authority. The Congress has legal authority. They can compel action. They need to compel action. That's their responsibility.
Now, Carl, why the failure to act on the president's part right now?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that if you look at President Obama, he really has, in certain ways, functioned as the calm captain of corporate interests within his presidency. When you look at what happened in terms of the economy, he bailed out the bankers with health care. He funneled health care through corporations. Instead of serving the people, he's really been subservient to corporate interests. And this is a defining moment for his presidency. Does he stand with the people, or does he defer to BP? BP is the responsible party. I mean, this was entirely avoidable. So why do we turn to BP and ask them, please, please give some money to the people that are so harmed? If you listen to what Tony Hayward is saying, I mean, let's put rhetoric and public announcements aside by Obama, and including by Hayward, but look at what he's saying to the financial industry. He has said that BP can get out from underneath this for $3 to $6 billion. Now, everyone that has looked at the scope of damage knows that it's not measured in $1, $2, $3, or $6 billion. It's measured in tens of billions of dollars. So when Hayward is telling the investment industry not to worry, BP will get out from underneath this for $3 to $6 billion, that is his statement of intent. He and BP do not intend to set aside the compensation that is due. They don't plan to pay the damages.
I think when you read the papers a little more carefully, the numbers are much, much bigger than that. I mean, you're saying they may even be bigger, but the numbers you're reading now are $20 billion, $26 billion. There's some economists out there saying that BP may not make it through this. It may be acquired, et cetera, et cetera.
Let's say that their assets are about $150 billion, but look at their profits. Their profits last year, $17 billion in profits. Now, when we talk about profits, we're talking about this is their excess cash after all the accounting tricks and maneuvers. I mean, $17 billion excess. They have the means to set aside substantial amounts of money. Now, maybe BP can come out of this and ultimately be unimpaired. We don't know. It depends on actually the total extent of the damage that they have caused. That's a determining element. But right now, we know BP can put aside $20 billion. It can access its lines of credit, which are reportedly $20 to $30 billion, which are there precisely for cash-constrained times. They have the means to do it. They have market capitalization. They are a massive corporation. They, of all corporations, have the means to do it. This is the same corporation that chose to not put in $500,000 safety valves that would have prevented this from happening, that would have been a fail-safe.
I think the issue is going to come up very soon because there's a dividend payout coming up in the next month or two that would amount to about $10 billion. if BP pays out that dividend, then it's going to be precisely what you're saying, Carl, which is basically giving the money out rather than giving it to the people who really deserve it.
Well, that's correct. It's an alienation. It's a giveaway of assets. It's placing when they issue those dividends, what they're doing is taking that money and placing it out of reach of the courts, out of reach of anyone, and most critically, out of reach of the victims.
Carl, is Seas BP planning actions in advance of those payouts?
Certainly. Already we've had national actions from most recently, a week and a half ago, we had demonstrations over the course of 1 week in 60 cities across the country, as far east as Boston, and at least 5 cities in Florida, as far west as Hawaii, and of course in many communities that are directly affected, in Mississippi, in Louisiana, in Alabama, people have come out and they've come around this one simple demand. This is just a simple demand for compensation. Take assets commensurate with the damage, put them in trust, and make sure that there is an immediate claims process that's simple, that people can get to. And from our perspective, what's critical with any trust or claims process is that the people who work, the wage earners in the affected states, will be able to make claims and get paid, not just the property owners. We understand there's going to be recognition clearly for people who own real property, but what about the wage earners? There needs to be a way for the housekeeper, who no longer is going to be able to work this season or maybe the next season, to be able to put in a claim. That's the test of any claims process. Will the wage earners, who have a real property interest in their livelihoods, in their wages, will they be able to petition and submit claims and know that this month, when they're not earning wages because of BP's oil spill, that they will be able to put food on the table, pay the rent, and have a livelihood?
We're speaking with attorney Carl Massinio with the Partnership for Civil Justice in Washington, D.C. Carl, do you have a website that our listeners can go to connect with the Seas BP campaign that you're helping to organize?
Certainly. They can go to seasbp.org. And when you go there, we have a number of things that you can do. You need to sign up on the website for email updates because that's the only way to get up-to-date information about what is going on as well as analysis. I mean, today and yesterday and actually throughout this week here in Washington, D.C., we've had actions at the White House. On Thursday, there's going to be a demonstration in Los Angeles. On Friday, in New Orleans, in front of Halliburton's offices. They're happening everywhere.
Carl, I saw a program on television recently that sort of brought you inside the command center for cleanup efforts and emergency response. I heard that it really hasn't been that well organized, that it's unclear sort of who's in charge. And that's something that we've seen in this kind of disaster over the past decade or two. Does the Seas BP have a comment on that?
Well, we certainly have seen those accounts as well. I think that there is a problem. The U.S. government has willingly decided, it has chosen over the years to be incompetent. And this is something that they admit. They are incompetent technologically and in terms of resources to be able to respond to the oil spill using government resources. They say that honestly, and that's a decision because certainly the U.S. government has the resources to be able to respond if it chose to garner them. It's a problem. I think that genuinely BP probably really wants that well to be capped. But there is no system in place. And one of the reasons why there's no system in place is because, to say lax oversight by the government is an incredible understatement. The government let the oil industry regulate or non-regulate itself. The government, the Department of Interior, including under Obama, allowed them to submit plans that said that oil spills were not going to happen. And what we saw with President Obama is that in March, he reversed course from his campaign policies in terms of offshore drilling. In March, he announced an expansion of it. He said he did so after great thought and consideration. On April 2nd, Obama himself came out and in response to questions said, you know, oil rigs don't cause oil spills. They are too technologically advanced. Now, the reason why there's disorganization is because the government accepted the representations of the oil industry, that oil spills were a thing of the past. And I think we all understand.
They said that, Carl. They said they were a thing of the past, but they were required to supposedly put in plans for an oil spill if it happened. And then, of course, what came out in the congressional testimony this week, that each of the plans of the three or five major oil companies was written by the same expert, and they were all BS. They said we can take 200,000 gallons a day, 250,000, and they listed, and they could tell they were BS in the same plans because they listed the same phone numbers for people who were long dead in the plans. And so when they compared the plans, the cleanup plans were all just done there as paperwork, you know, to cover over any idea that this might be a serious problem if there was a spill. And of course, as we've seen, they are. Now, let me ask you, you know, Obama's been very criticized. I mean, to the extent he starts jumping around and screaming, it's he who said, let's go ahead and do offshore drilling. He's being tough on himself. He's being tough on Congress. It's not just BP. BP reminds me in this a little bit like Goldman Sachs. Yeah, they're the tip of the bad, very bad pyramid here. But underneath, you have an entire industrial complex, which is in the pocket, which has our government officials in their pockets, and is running the whole business.
But that's absolutely correct. And the thing is, Obama can't just stand and say it's inertia from the bad policies of George Bush. He came out, he made personal decisions to expand offshore oil drilling, and he came out and, like, taking a page out of the PR playbook of the oil industry, he made those nonsensical statements in defense of his policy that we don't have to worry about oil spills because oil rigs don't cause them. We all know that's nonsense. His administration, as well as all the other administrations, his is no worse than any other. It's the same. There is no change. They let the oil industry regulate or non-regulate themselves.
Let's say they weren't to regulate themselves. Let's say we really do get a good regulation system in there. Can there ever be really a guarantee that a well at 5,000 feet under the ocean is ever not going to do this again?
Well, I think that we all understand that accidents, that is, unintended consequences happen. And they're going to happen, and when they happen, 5,000 feet underwater, they're going to be extremely difficult to deal with. So that's why there needs to be independent, redundant systems to be able to respond to catastrophes. That's why they needed to put in the $500,000 valve, the safety valve that was a failsafe. Yes, accidents will happen, but the damage can be contained. The damage can be contained with simple measures that cost money up front, but it's a fraction of what the costs of cleanup are, as we can see.
I remember, Carl, in law school, torts class, we had the case of the Ford Pinto, where it came out that Ford knew of a defective gas tank.
It hit the gas tank, it was too near the surface or the side, and the thing exploded, right?
Right. But
so
they
what's wrong with that?
Well, they made a decision, and this was sort of one of the fundamental concepts that we were being taught in torts, is that big business calculates in terms of profits and expenses. And to me, that's exactly what we're seeing here. The government knows accidents are going to happen. It's going to cost a fortune to clean them up. And yet in the grand scheme, they're taking that gamble.
Well, that's exactly correct. It is a profit maximizer. Its goal is to make as much money as possible, is to limit its expenditures in order to maximize its profits. It cannot be counted on to make these decisions where everything hangs in the balance. I mean, these handful of individuals hold in their hand the safety and the ecology of, clearly, between 5 and 10 coastal states. It can't be left to the profit-making decision because that decision is going to turn out the way it has here.
Carl, with these huge modern corporations, it's usually a handful of people and only a small percentage of stockholders that really run the corporation. What interests are involved in BP, and how do they overlap with other corporations and other financial institutions?
Well, you know who the largest servicer and holder of shares of BP is? It's the Chase Bank. I mean, this is, we hear them projecting, the poor individual investor who's going to be harmed by their placing money in the stock of BP and having risk their money in a bad gamble. But a lot of it is held by institutional and financial investment.
Carl, so tell us what's going to happen next in the campaign, where are some demonstrations going to happen, the website and stuff like that.
What is happening next? Well, what is happening next depends very much on what the administration does. We have been responsive in terms of current events. We expect there to be ongoing demonstrations that occur to maintain pressure on this administration. It has the authority to do what's necessary. It has the authority under the Constitution that the President and the Congress can take those assets, can set it aside, can make sure the people in the Gulf Coast are able to pay the rent, are able to be made whole immediately. So we're going to continue to advocate for that. We're not going to go away. We're going to have demonstrations, continue to have demonstrations across the nation as is necessary, letter to the editor campaigns, and we'll be out in front of the White House every day of the week if that's what it takes to get the pressure through.
Carl, will you risk civil disobedience on this cause?
I think that there is a wide range of tactics. Whatever is necessary to be effective. I mean, what is happening down in the Gulf is so compelling, and the suffering is so severe, it is absolutely necessary for this administration to take notice.
Carl, the advantage of having three people interview you is that one of them can keep looking online to seeing what's cooking. And I just got a CNN breaking news story that said BP to put $20 billion into a fund to pay for Gulf oil disaster claims, senior administration official tells CNN. So I presume that's because of your work, but I'd like some reaction to that.
Well, the devil is in the details, right? We believe that a trust fund is essential, but who is going to be handling the claims process? Are wage earners going to be able to submit claims? It's important. There are a number of things that have to be established for any trust fund or escrow account to be meaningful, for it to not just be a phony fund, but a fund that provides real relief. The funds need to be sufficient. They need to be made available. And they need to be made through a claims process that makes sure that the working people of the Gulf Coast, not just the big businesses, not just the states, but the wage earners are going to be able to go in there, make their claims. The servers who work in the tourist industry, the housekeepers who work at hotels, if they can't make claims, if they can't get their lost wages, then it's not sufficient.
Carl Massinio from the Partnership for Civil Justice. He's an attorney. He's heading up the Seize BP actions. That's seizebp.org. Carl, great work. Thanks so much for being a guest on Law and Disorder.
And thank you all
thank
for
you,
having
Carl.
Me. Bye, Carl.
Excellent
thank you.
Program. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Baby, y'all, I got a story I want to tell somebody. In my life I've seen a lot of things go. I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Been down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you would do until you put under pressure. Across 110th Street is a hell of a tester.
Across 110th Street,
push you won't let a junkie go free.
Across 110th Street,
boys are trying to catch a trick on the street.
Across 110th Street,
you can find it all in the street. I don't mean to bother you, but I got one more thing I wanna say. Hey brother, there's a better way out. Snorting that coke, shooting that dope, man, you're copping out. Take my advice, it's either live or die. You gotta be strong, brother, if you wanna survive. You see, the family on the upper side of town will catch hell if a ghetto wasn't around. Every city, you find the same thing going down. Harlem is the capital of any ghetto town.
Across 110th Street,
the
pimps are trying to catch a woman that's weak. Across 110th Street, push a rope, let a junkie go free. Oh, across 110th Street, oh, they're trying to catch a trick on the street, yeah. Across 110th Street, you can find it. Do it again, just like a fish hooked on a line. The man's got his way, reeling you in a little at a time. Up on 110th Street, pimps are trying to catch a woman.